As more and more people struggle to pay their credit card debts, one segment of the industry is booming: third-party debt collection. Third-party debt collectors take over the accounts of very, very delinquent credit card customers, people who haven't paid a bill in more than 200 days. Trying to recover money from them is not easy. Our Planet Money reporter Alex Bloomberg talked with a third-party debt collector about what that job is like.
In the nearly 3 years that John Goebel has worked in debt collections, calling people on the phone to try to get them to pay their overdue bills, he says the responses break down into three categories, none of them good.
Maybe 60% anger, if not more, maybe 75, 10 or 20% just complete apathy. And then you don't typically hear the sadness unless you stop and talk with somebody. And then you kind of watch them unfold and kind of break down, which may happen maybe, I would say, 10% of the time.
I mean, how often when you're doing this do you have people just break down and cry on the phone?
Oh, I mean, I would say at least once a week.
Keep in mind, John's part-time now. When he was full-time, it happened almost daily. John works in a cubicle wearing a telephone headset attached to an automated dialer, which weeds out busy signals and voicemail. And he tries to avoid getting into the sad stuff with people. Partially because if at the end of a long 40-minute story the person still doesn't pay anything, well, John's not doing his job. But that's only one reason.
The emotional part of it, it drags you down. I mean, it's very hard to, if somebody breaks down and pours their life out to you and then, you know, you work out something, you don't work out something, the second you hang up that call, you have maybe 5 seconds until the next call picks up, depending on how fast that dialer's moving. You might only have 5 seconds, somebody else is there, and you got to talk to them. It's very hard to just flip that off and then start talking to the next person. So I think it's almost a defense mechanism. You know, you kind of turn off some, you have to turn off some part of you that you can't put yourself in everybody's shoes.
John says there are cases where he feels bad, like the guy whose son committed suicide, whose wife left him, whose business failed. He says in situations like that, he just apologizes, hangs up the phone, doesn't try for any money. But he says when you have people yelling at you all day long, it doesn't put you in a very charitable frame of mind. He's had people curse at him, lie to him.
Maybe they'll give their phone to their kid and have their kid talk to me.
Wait, somebody gave the phone to their kid and had your
kid? That happens all the time. They'll have their kids answer the phone, and I've had people in the background say I'm not here, or tell them to go to hell, and they'll have what sound like six-year-olds saying this.
John works this job on top of his day job to help pay off his student loans. He himself has a credit card with a balance, but these days he hardly ever uses it. Unlike some of his buddies from college, John says he wouldn't be surprised if one of them turned up on his automated dialer one day. He sees debt a little like a drug. The benefits, a new flat screen TV say, happen immediately, but the consequences don't show up for months or even years. Credit cards can be dangerous, and a lot of people he talks to don't really understand how they work.
There's such a knowledge gap. If you don't understand how compounding interest works, or you don't, even just simple interest, if you don't understand how that works, should you have a credit card that, you know, uses the, you know, 60-day average balance and it's a revolving line of credit? I mean, that's a little bit more complicated than that.
Right now, explaining how this stuff actually works falls to people like John. By the time it gets to him, it's probably too late. For NPR News, I'm Alex Bloomberg.
And our next story takes us to China, where there are signs of a housing bubble in the making. Here are some of the indicators. Housing prices are way up. Property sales jumped 75% in the last year. And bank loans are at record levels. NPR's Louisa Lim reports from one of the places where housing prices are rising the fastest, Shanghai.
Rise up, people who don't want to be slaves to their mortgages, are the words to this satirical song. Its tune is the Anto Nacional, the anthem of international socialism. The lyrics say, we should fight for houses, shatter the developers to pieces. Don't think we're obedient, the consequences will be serious if we get mad. This song, protesting against high house prices, was written just over 3 years ago by songwriter Liu Shuqiu.
At that time, nobody could afford to buy apartments. We thought prices were at their peak. We never could have known that over the years it would get worse and worse.
In fact, fact, house prices are almost 2.5 times higher now than when that song was written. A new Shanghai apartment now costs 68% more than it did a year ago, according to Knight Frank Property Agency. It says prices rose by 40% in many other mainland cities. Now ordinary people fear they're being priced out of the market, while the luxury sector is soaring. James Straw is a property agent for Century 21, working in Lujiazui, one of Shanghai's most expensive areas. He describes the type of customer who was buying last year. In this case, a coal mine millionaire from the inland province of Shanxi.
Last year, one of my customers arrived in a BMW, lugging two suitcases. Each suitcase contained the equivalent of about $70,000. He said, "I've brought this money to buy a villa."
Even China's premier, Wen Jiabao, admits that property prices have risen too quickly. The government's trying to stop speculation by reimposing resale taxes and raising down payments for second homes. Many fear China's in the grip of a property bubble. Experts say the problem isn't the same as the subprime mortgages in the US.
The entities that are doing the leveraging in China are not individual people, but instead local government entities, which have borrowed trillions from the banking system to develop real estate projects in the first place.
Victor Shi from Northwestern University has been researching local governments' finances in China. He says, for example, about half of the Shanghai government's revenues come from land sales. And because local governments need this income, he fears cooling measures might not work.
Local governments now are forming their own real estate developers and would actually buy land from itself. As this becomes more common, and it is becoming very, very common, then local governments have a high stakes in maintaining and increasing the value of real estate in their own jurisdiction. Therefore, I think local governments may intentionally ignore a lot of measures that are meant to deflate real estate prices.
But not everyone is convinced there is a property bubble. Some analysts cite continuing housing demand, fueled in part by the millions of rural migrants moving to the city. Liu Zhengwei, the Industrial Bank's macroeconomic analyst, says prices are likely to continue going up in the medium term.
Economists say the biggest factor in housing prices is demographics, and China's working population doesn't reach its peak until 2030. So I think China still has 15 or 20 years of growth, with some fluctuations because of macroeconomic controls.
Bubble or no bubble, official figures show 85% of Chinese can no longer afford to buy properties. And the authorities are certainly worried about social instability. That much is clear from the popularity of this television soap opera, Dwelling Narrowness. It charts two sisters' struggles to buy an apartment, with one of them eventually becoming the mistress of a corrupt official. It coined a saying, "To buy a place in Shanghai means you're digging a grave for yourself and burying your love." The soap opera has now been pulled from the air. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. You can expect to hear a lot about jobs tonight as President Obama tries to defend his. Economic recovery is likely to dominate the State of the Union speech, and Mr. Obama faces a new sense of urgency after a Republican won a surprising victory in last week's special Senate election in Massachusetts. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The State of the Union speech is always an important milestone for any administration. But presidential scholar Fred Greenstein of Princeton says for President Obama tonight, the stakes are higher than usual.
The tide seems to be running against him suddenly, very forcefully, and it's important that he do what some presidents before him have done, which is to make a real correction and turn things around.
Mr. Obama badly needs to change the subject after last week's special election in Massachusetts. As he told a gathering of U.S. mayors last week, the subject he wants to start talking about is jobs.
You can expect a continued, sustained, and relentless effort to create good jobs for the American people. I will not rest until we've gotten there.
If Mr. Obama had his way, he would have been paying more public attention to jobs long ago. But events kept getting in the way. The opening days of the president's new year were consumed by questions about the failed terrorist attack on Christmas Day. and talks about health care, which Mr. Obama once hoped to finish last summer, instead dragged on and on. If last week's Massachusetts vote didn't sound the death knell for health care legislation, it did at least signal a timeout. Delaware Governor Jack Markell, who chairs the Democratic Governors Association, says Mr. Obama now has no choice but to focus on the jobs message.
Even before Massachusetts, everybody was on alert that the voters are looking for solutions. And that's exactly what we've got to provide. There's a burden of proof, particularly amongst independent voters, and that's why we've got to prove we've got the right ideas to put people back to work in our states.
Markell believes the Obama administration deserves some credit for helping to arrest the economic freefall. But he says there's a lot more work to be done.
We're not out of the woods. Although we do get reports from economists and the like, the best information that I get is from business people on the street here in Delaware. And there's a long way to go before businesses are more confident. But I think we're certainly moving in that direction as opposed to where we were a year ago.
Although the government's economic stimulus measure has helped cushion the recession, unemployment still hovers at 10%. Mr. Obama has proposed more road and bridge building, incentives for home energy retrofits, and a jobs tax credit. Economic advisor Christina Romer says the tax credit is designed to encourage more small businesses to hire.
These are businesses that are probably saying, I'm seeing demand start to come back. Maybe a year from now I'll start doing some hiring. If we gave them some tax incentives, might they say, well, I was going to hire in 2011, let me hire in 2010. We know that would be good for them, good for the economy, good for workers that get jobs.
As Mr. Obama underscores the jobs message tonight, he'll also be talking fiscal discipline, and he'll try to explain how other initiatives, such as financial reform or clean energy legislation, fit into a broader economic picture. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says even the long-running health care battle was ultimately about protecting workers' economic security.
I don't believe the president thinks that we should stop fighting for what's important to the middle class. No doubt there will be calls to abandon financial reform. There'll be calls by some to abandon wanting taxpayers to be paid back for their loans to Wall Street. I don't think the president would agree with those.
Princeton's Greenstein says if Mr. Obama succeeds in addressing voters' economic worries, many of their other doubts about the president may disappear. Over the weekend, Mr. Obama took time out from working on the speech to play basketball with his two daughters. Greenstein says the president needs a rhetorical slam dunk tonight. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another debate from Intelligence Squared U.S. I'm John Donvan of ABC News. And once again, it is my pleasure to serve as host and moderator as the six debaters you see sharing the stage with me here at the Skirball Center for the Performing Arts at New York University. Six debaters, three against three, will be debating this motion. California is the first failed state. Now, I want to point out that this is a debate. It's not a symposium or a seminar. It is a contest. And you, our audience, serve as our judges. By the time the debate has concluded, you will have been asked to vote twice, once before the debate and once again after. At the end of the debate, the team that has changed the most minds will be declared our winner. And so to round one, opening statements by each debater in turn. Our first debater speaking for the motion, California is the first failed state, Andreas Kluth, who is The Economist's West Coast correspondent. He covers politics, society, and the economy in California and the western states. He spent a long time working out of New York, having made the move to California. Andreas, I understand in your office you work from a yoga mat. Is this not the influence of California?
Oh, that's a Tommy mat in the lotus position. That's true.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andreas Kluth.
I'm willing to prove it. Thank you. The proposition is cheeky. As all of you know, all good Oxford-style debates start with a cheeky proposition. The reason this one is cheeky is that failed states usually refer to sovereign states. And what those have in common is that they have lost a monopoly on legitimate violence, if you think that through, or maybe back to poli-sci. When that happens, warlords take over, or maybe Somalian pirates, and the state, as such, loses authority. Well, clearly, no one on the stage tonight is going to argue that California is already ruled by warlords or pirates. So what are we talking about when we talk about one of the 50 states, domestic states? California and other domestic states that may follow have failed if they fail to support their citizens and instead hinder them. California easily meets those criteria. Prisons, California has the worst recidivism rate in the country. How did it get like that? Education. Before California became a failed state in the Pat Brown era of the 50s and 60s, it built the best public university system in the country. It is currently dismantling that because it is now a failed state. Budgets. And a state is supposed to have a budget to pass it on time. California never does. That started well before the recession. And when you have all problems simultaneously, you tie them together into a straitjacket, and that's what California is in. It's in a straitjacket because of its governance structures. I want to show you what the unique aspect of that confluence is. Unique, number one, three states, for example, have this supermajority requirement that both houses of a legislature have two-thirds of votes to pass a budget. Three states. 16 states have the same supermajority required to raise taxes. Only one state has both. How did California get that second supermajority requirement? It was the infamous Prop 13. I understand it's famous even on this coast. Only one state has the process really run certifiably amok, out of control, insane. In only one state do the inmates run the asylum. Our opponents are great orators. Don't let them confuse you tonight. California is the first failed state.
Thank you, Andreas Kluth. Our motion is California is the first failed state. You've heard the first opening statement in support of the motion. Now to speak first against the motion, Gray Davis, the 37th governor of California, who happens to be, like me, Bronx-born. Governor Davis encountered direct democracy head-on-head when he lost a recall election in 2003, but prior to that, he had won almost every election he had ever run in as he served as state controller and as lieutenant governor. He is, though Bronx-born, a true Californian. Ladies and gentlemen, Gray Davis.
First, let me acknowledge that there are problems in Sacramento, but the shortcomings of our elected officials should not detract from the creative contributions of our 37 million citizens. Our GDP, which is one way we measure societies in this world, is $1.9 trillion, far and away the largest in America, in fact, the eighth largest in the world. So one way we measure societies in a capitalistic world is by their GDP, and certainly California has no apologies for that. With all of its problems, it still managed to nurture some of the most innovative companies in the world, Google, Apple, Hewlett-Packard, Cisco, Intel, Disney, eBay, and many other companies that are helping invent the future for California and for America. It likes to get there first, and it frequently does. It was the first state to regulate greenhouse gases. It was the first to establish renewable energy portfolio standards. What do I mean by that? It said to its utilities, use renewable energy, depend less on fossil fuel. In fact, our electricity growth has been nada, zippo, zero over 30 years as we became the largest state in America. The rest of the country is more than 50%. Why do I tell you that? Because how America obtains energy in the future will be critical to our economy, our environment, and to national security. And I submit to you that California's proven leadership in this area over the last 35 years will stand this nation in very good stead. Now, to be sure, we have problems in Sacramento, but believe me, the voters have tuned into this issue, and they have already made change that's substantial. For many years, the legislators drew their own districts, meaning they decided in what district they would run. They decided you would be in my district, you would not. And so, not surprisingly, they almost never lose. Governor Schwarzenegger proposed a redistricting plan. It passed. I supported it because I believe it's time the voters draw the lines, not the people. Finally, there's a call for a constitutional convention. I support that idea. It's time we eliminated, in my judgment, the two-third vote requirement to pass a budget. Our public sector is on the mend and will get better at the end of 2010. Vote no. Number two, vote no.
Our motion is California is the first failed state, and up now to argue for this motion, to argue that California is the first failed state, I'd like to introduce Sharon Waxman, who has a long and distinguished career working for the New York Times and the Washington Post, both as a foreign correspondent and as a correspondent reporter covering the entertainment industry. She has started a web portal on the entertainment industry known as therap.com, and though you are arguing that California is a failed state, you believe enough to base your business there.
Yeah, I like the weather.
Okay. It makes sense. Ladies and gentlemen, Sharon Waxman.
So let's start with the area I know best that I deal with every day, and that's Hollywood. Hollywood, the symbol, a signature of California, and a symbol, of course, to the world of California's industry, creativity, prosperity, and the values of American culture. Here's the only problem with that. Hollywood's not really in Hollywood anymore. It's gone to New Mexico and Arizona and New York and Vancouver and London. Hundreds and thousands of jobs that produce this juggernaut of not just jobs but of tax revenues to the state has largely fled. Film production is down to half of what it was in California in 1996. And the reason for me, it has a lot to do with California failing to create a sense of connectedness with this incredibly core industry. It's so much of what we ought to be proud of. But by the way, of course, the entertainment industry is one of America's top exports, not only California. It seems to me that the state has neglected it, and as it has neglected so many things. Finally, I want to speak to you as a mother. I'm the mother of three children, and I moved my family from Europe, actually, to raise them in California. At the very least, I knew that coming to California, that I was moving to a state that had the best public university system in the country, if not the world. Today, that system has been, I feel, taken away from us. Because of the problems with the state, they've just, again, you've probably all read about it, raised the fees some 30% in the UC system. How is it that the state is abdicating its role in creating a generation of the best and the brightest in the state of California, which was all about what California represented? It has neglected its fundamental industries, it has neglected its fundamental functions, and it has neglected its fundamental values as a state.
Thank you, Sharon Waxman. I'd like to introduce Van Jones. Van Jones was the co-founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and Green for All. He was part of the Obama administration as special advisor for green jobs. He resigned that position after being targeted in a nasty political imbroglio, but his standing in the greenest state in the nation is enormously high in the green movement. And Van, I saw on Facebook a draft Van Jones for governor page. Would you want the job?
Being honest, sir, and I'll tell you why. First of all, California is not a failed state, and our colleagues have pretty much conceded that they cannot win this argument based on the assertion that it's a failed state. So instead, they point to some failings. But what they haven't told you is that every single one of the problems, structural and otherwise, that have been pointed to have solutions, and the solutions are now on the way. When you look at a state like California, you look at a state that on the three critical issues that are most important for our country, California is not failing. It is succeeding and it is leading. Number one, how will we power America? In California, we have quadrupled in the past 2 years the amount of venture capital flowing into the state because we are trying to solve the biggest problem humanity faces, the problem of global warming, and the biggest problem our country faces, the problem of energy independence. California is leading and succeeding in that. Number two, yes, Sacramento has a ton of problems, but the entire state of California does not live in Sacramento. We have an incredible level of innovation at the governance level, cities and regionally across the state. In Northern California, you have mayors like Gavin Newsom, Ron Dellums, and others who've come together, who've come up with local creative financing to get green home improvements going, weatherization and solar panels, attached to property taxes so people can actually get all these new technologies going. These are the kinds of things that are happening on a daily basis. And those things don't happen in a failed state. And the last thing I want to say is that the third big challenge for this country and for this world is, how are we going to live together? In the age of this kind of diversity, how are we going to live together? there are in Oakland, California, there are 30 to 40 different languages spoken in the public schools. To the extent that there is conflict, it's not about that. We've been able to figure out a way to come together, to work together. That is not just a good example for the United States. That's a good example for the world. This is not a failed state. We have some failings. But this state is a state that is now rallying to solve those problems. Don't vote against us. Vote for us. Thank you very much.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores.
Okay, a reminder of where we are. We are halfway through the opening round of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan of ABC News. We are listening to opening statements from each side. We have six debaters, two teams of three, and they are fighting it out over this motion. California is the first failed state. And now to argue for that motion, to argue that California is the first failed state, I'd like to introduce Bobby Shriver, who is a councilman in Santa Monica and co-founder of One.org and a scion of one of America's greatest political families. Ladies and gentlemen, Bobby Shriver.
Thank you very much. I appreciated our eloquence of some of our colleagues, but I want to point out very, very specifically that all the answers are on the way. They're not here now. And I can tell you in local government, where I serve on the city council in Santa Monica, things are bad. We're lucky in Santa Monica because we have a great diverse tax base. But just to give you a couple of illustrations, our redevelopment agency had a budget this year of $30 million. The state took $22 million of that. How can you work on that basis? And this is a reminder also that when you talk about the state, you're not talking about Google and Intel. And you're not talking about local government. You're talking about the state government. It's very important. The state is a constitutional entity. It's a legal entity. It's not California, obviously. I'll give you another example. In Los Angeles, you have the biggest homeless population in America, 80,000-plus people. The L.A. County Jail is the largest mental health facility in the world. If you go there, every single one of you, I don't care what your background or point of view on this debate would be sickened to see what's going on in there. We have completely failed. You go in that L.A. County Jail, you will see the weakest people in our society, mentally ill people living in cages. They have 14 full-time pharmacists to medicate them. Of the 85 or some odd thousand people who are homeless, about a third are veterans. You can't have that many homeless people. You can't have the underfunding of education that exists. You can't have that many homeless veterans and say that the state has been successful in creating amongst its citizens a concept of political compassion, that we're going to get together. We have community interests. We're going to get together, and we're going to do something about them. And ideas are on the way, and green tech, great. For the least of these, it's not fantastic in California. It's really not. I'll give you another example, local example. City of Beverly Hills has a school system. Santa Monica has one. The state is organized in school districts. They had kids from out of the city of Beverly Hills in that district because the state used to pay, and still may, a certain amount per student. So you would bring people from out of your district who were not there and educate them. They changed that formula recently. What did Beverly Hills do? And they're not bad people. They expelled all those kids. Why? We're not getting paid for it anymore. That's a state failure, not a Beverly Hills failure, not a failure of those communities. And I like to be optimistic, and I am optimistic. When they asked me which side of this debate I want to be on, I said I wanted to be on this one. They said, well, don't you want to be on the optimistic side? I said, this is the optimistic side. This is the optimistic side. Because if you don't know that the problem is as bad as it is, you think that help is on the way. Help is not on the way. Thank you.
Thank you, Bobby Shriver. California is the first failed state is our motion. And you have heard all of the debaters but one. Next up to argue against this motion, Lawrence O'Donnell, who has one of these Renaissance man resumes, having held positions as a political analyst for MSNBC and having served as chief of staff for the U.S. Senate Finance Committee, and for being a writer and producer on West Wing and for being an actor on Big Love as well. It's a lot. Thanks for coming by.
I had some prepared material, which I will use some of, but I would like to very quickly go through some of the points that you've heard from the presenters of this preposterous idea. I want to, though, give you the correct concept that you're aiming for here in the title of this proposition is that the first failed state. What that means is it the worst of 50 states? All this side has to do, all it has to do, is give you the idea that there might be somewhere in the 50 states, somewhere, one, that's doing something worse than California, or maybe doing everything worse than California, and, oh, by the way, might also be a slightly less desirable place to live. That's our chore. We have to find you one that you don't want to live in. You'll hear about different problems. You'll hear Bobby talking about the homeless. That's important. That is tragic. But remember what the case is here. The case is it somehow a California issue? California has more homeless people than any other state. It has more wealth than any other state. It has more poverty than any other state. It has more agricultural production than any other state. It has more people. It has more. Every single thing they will tell you about anecdotally, yes, California has the most of it. The budget cuts in the university system, budget cuts, educational budget cuts have been mentioned. Take your time. Take all the time you need to come up with the name of a better public university. Not in the 50 states, in the world, a better public university than the University of California at Berkeley. Take your time. We have all night. The delicious irony of having this debate in this state. The New York Times, in its seemingly endless editorial series called The Failed State. It stars, as usual, Albany. I lived here longer than I've lived in Los Angeles. I worked in government with Senator Moynihan. What we discovered and what we harped on endlessly back in the 80s and 90s was New York sends more money to the federal government than it gets back, hence all of its budget problems. Well, the problem is much worse in California. California gets 79 cents back for every dollar that it sends to the federal government. So the reason you don't have 40 other so-called failed states is because California tax money is paying for Alabama. It's paying to keep Alaska running. It's paying to keep Arkansas afloat. You can't balance any of the books in those states without the money that comes out of California pockets to fund it.
Thank you, Lawrence O'Donnell. And that concludes round one of this Intelligence Square debate. This is a debate from Intelligence Squared U.S. I'm John Donvan of ABC News, serving as moderator, and our motion is California is the first failed state. We asked you in the audience, who will be serving as our ultimate judges, before the debate began, to tell us where you stood on this issue. Before the debate on the motion, California is the first failed state, 31% of you were for the motion, 25% against, and 44% are undecided. So it's really wide open. Now moving on to round two. And in round two, the debaters address each other directly, and they also take questions from myself and from you in the audience. And I begin with a question to the team that is arguing that California is the first failed state. You have been making an argument primarily that the failure of the state of California is largely a political failure, the failure of the political system leading to gridlock and, as a result, lack of services. The other team, they're listing several kinds of successes. They are listing successes in innovation and in technology and in the development of greening the state and personal connections, political connections on a small scale. They're coming back at you with success. Andreas Kluth of The Economist, what's wrong with that argument?
Well, in particular, Governor Gray Davis was making that point. I wrote down a direct quote from you, Governor. In California, the private sector is the envy of the world. The public sector is on the mend. You asked me what's wrong with the logic of the first part, and in fact, I'd like to do that and the second part as well. And examine the first part and go and take a larger period of history, a few hundred years. The most elegant leather shoes come from a town near Bologna in northern Italy. The best violins come from another town in northern Italy.
That's been that way for hundreds of years. Would you honestly make the case, would you have made the case for much of post-war history that Italy was not a failed state in the European Union because they had a great shoe industry and a great violin industry in the northern Italy?
Gray Davis, to respond.
It is irrelevant. The other point, just briefly, you cannot seriously say that the public sector is on the mend at the very moment when they're dismantling entire government programs that were intended to protect the weakest, and people are literally going to die, certain old people at home, because home visits are stopping.
Andres, let's have Gray Davis respond to your first point.
The state is not an abstraction. It is the sum total of the energy, the vibrancy, the creativity, and the innovation of 37 million people. So for Andres to dismiss all the energy, the excitement, the creativity that is producing the iPhone and the social networking and alternative energy. We've got ExxonMobil investing $600 million into a San Diego project that will turn algae into oil. I mean, if that's not the establishment saying you're doing something smart in California, I don't know what that's about. Now, to say that's not part of the state is to say the state is just some civil servants and some black boxes we don't know anything about. The state are human beings getting up every day, doing their best to make the world a better place, expecting to succeed, frequently succeeding, but realizing that risk takers though they are, failure will occasionally occur. I mean, are we looking into algae and oil in New York? Are we looking into algae and oil in Kansas? Are we looking into algae and oil in Mississippi?
They are in Nevada and Arizona, and especially if you want to talk about the green economy, look to Denmark, China, Israel.
Gray Davis.
Do I get it? We just have to find one state that's doing less on oil to algae.
Lawrence.
If there's one state that's doing less on oil to algae, we win. You're going to hear a lot about budget cutting, and they're going to have to cut back on home health care visits and things like that. There are 43 states that have cut their enacted budgets of 2009. They enacted budgets for 2009. 43 of them went back and cut them, okay? And now in searching for new areas of revenue so they don't have to cut quite so much money, the brilliant idea that your governor here in New York is proposing is to legalize ultimate fighting. Congratulations.
Bobby Shriver.
Since Lawrence is so funny and so experienced, I just have to do a few little catch-ups here. They don't win if there's another failed state. That's not true. It's whether this is the first failed state. So he would have to say that, here in New York, that New York is the first failed state. Maybe that'd give him a little bit of a point. But
Lawrence, I think he's got you on that.
I don't think that's what it is. Let me do a couple of things. Berkeley is a great university. You know what it costs to go to Berkeley a year? $30,000+ a year. Is that a public university? It's owned by the public. But when you say, find a better one than Berkeley, that's not a public university. The original act that created Berkeley, you went to Berkeley free. Free is public. Free is the community. $30,000 of after-tax money per year is not free.
Let's let Gray Davis come back.
Okay. The fees have gone up. As governor, I opposed every fee, but the fee to be an undergraduate in Berkeley this year is $10,000.
Okay, well, then I'm wrong. I read it
undergraduate.
In the L.A. Times that it will rise.
The graduate schools of law and business for several years have been allowed to float up, and they are, as Sharon suggested, $25,000, $30,000, but PhD candidates are very low.
Even to me, at $10,000, it's for people who have modest incomes.
$10,000
of after tax money is a real thing. Second thing is, I think if you support, which I do too, a constitutional convention, when have people had constitutional conventions? The National Constitutional Convention was when there was a big old mess at hand. You don't have a constitutional convention when things are going great. They have to lose because you don't have a constitutional convention.
Let's bring in Van Jones.
In a successful or a less than failed state.
Van Jones is
the
arguing
rules
against
change by the minute here.
Exactly. Well, first of all, you're conceding the point, which is that we have in California the tools to continue to solve these problems. And when you say you have a failed state, which you're suggesting, first of all, you're trying to take off the table the economic successes are a function especially in the clean tech area, of policy successes, of political successes. We have been able to put aside partisan differences on one question, which is, if we are going to have the jobs of tomorrow in California, we've got to have the technology of tomorrow, make the products of tomorrow. It's striking to me. I've never heard of a failed state where that is the eighth largest economy in the world. I've never heard of a failed state that is literally one-eighth of the output for the entire country. So I think, again, you're conceding when you talk about the fact that we're talking about a constitutional convention, we're talking about a whole raft, California Ford and other folks are talking about a whole raft of fixes. We've got the tools and the innovation and determination to fix the problems in California.
So you're saying, Van, that the existence of an ambulance team means that the hospital is basically not shut down quite yet.
If you want to go with that analogy, I'm making the difference. I'm saying that the patient's not dead. And that's what these guys are trying to say.
I think that's a valid, actually quite cogent argument. Andreas, can you take that on?
Sure. So if you say if you want to change it to California is dead, then I have to tell you we're not debating that. We're not arguing it. By the way, I agree that failure, as you said, is an occasional stop. I happen to be writing a book at the moment about how failure and success are imposters. But you have to be honest that a failure has occurred in order to fix it. Californians are honest about it. That's why they will pass the two initiatives that will call for a constitutional convention, just as Americans after the Revolutionary War called a constitutional convention because the Articles of Confederation were a failure. And they accepted that and admitted that first, and then you start fresh. So you need to admit honestly that a failure has occurred, then you move on. Just a little bit of mopping up about the public universities. What is the still remaining excellence of the university system a sign of? It's a sign of the Pat Brown legacy when California was not a failed state. So don't get confused about this public university. It was a sign of something working well 30 years ago, and you will see when it's gone that something failed today.
And we will patiently await your naming of the state that spends more on its university system.
On a per capita basis?
Spends more on its university.
But this is your argument.
Exactly.
You kind of missed that.
I want to go to the audience for questions now. And again, raise your hand. I'll find you. There's a woman.
No one here has raised the issue of what was passed in 1979. And that was a proposition where basically negated the state from raising any tax revenues to feed everything that you're talking about, whether it's schools, public universities, services, art, what have you. Great that we have clean tech and we have the private industry and we have capitalism and competition. But if you don't have the public monies to support initiatives, where do you get it? You tax the capitalists?
Van Jones.
Well, the problem in California isn't primarily a revenue problem. I mean, we had a courageous governor, frankly, who was willing to do what needed to be done with regard to the so-called car tax, and put the $5 billion was on the table. That's off the table. We're the only state in only oil-producing state in the country that doesn't tax the oil when it comes out of the ground. There's $1 billion there. There are revenue sources that are available. The problem in California right now is, which is why we're here, is that we haven't agreed on the vision for California going forward. I think, obviously, Prop 13, from my point of view, has been a disaster for the state of California. But what I would say is simply this. We have an abundance of opportunity in the state of California because of the success of not just our clean – we brag on our clean tech sector because we're so proud of it – but we have 9 different regional economies. Which gives us the ability to do what countries do, frankly. We have an agricultural region, we have manufacturing, et cetera. And I think that where we are at this stage in the development of California's economy is we will fix the tax structure, we will fix the budgeting structure, we've already got redistricting done, and then anybody who bets against California right now is going to lose an awful lot of money.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. The motion is, California is the first failed state. Stay with us.
I haven't come to this side. This gentleman in a blue shirt, sir, you can stand up. Thanks.
Thank you. First of all, I think that the dwelling on the word first in the first failed state is honestly frivolous. I'd like to To pose, though, to Governor Davis, I was a San Francisco resident for 15 years, and I arrived feeling very, very excited about the idea of direct democracy. And it seems like we're avoiding that topic because, to my mind, it is the very prevalence of direct democracy that is ruining California and ruining California's political system. How do we fix the direct democracy problem in California?
Okay.
As somebody who was
I think everybody's nodding
official.
On this one. I'd like to go to Andreas. And Andreas, in 14 seconds, remind
the question was put to me.
Was
I
it?
Feel like
was
Reagan
it?
Saying, Mr. Green, this is my microphone.
I'm sorry.
I'm answering the question.
I apologize, Gray Davis. I had a moderator lapse.
I just want to ask you. I can speak with authority on direct democracy because I am a victim of it as well as this.
Can you take 10 seconds for the people who missed civics class that day? 10 seconds to remind us of what direct democracy involves.
Direct democracy in California basically means that all issues get to the voters sooner or later, and if they don't get to them sooner, the voters put an initiative on the ballot and take matters in their own hands. And basically, everything of consequence gets decided by the voters. They have the power, and I would suggest in our system of special interest, the only people who have the power to improve things in Sacramento. They can improve them further with the passage of the open primary, which I assure you the Republican Party will oppose, the Democratic Party will oppose, which ought to tell you how you should vote. And on all major issues like the Constitutional Convention, the vote in November will just be to go out and come back to us with recommendations. If we don't like the recommendations, we will vote them down. But we know the legislature, Republicans won't allow taxes increased, Democrats won't allow cuts in major programs. They are immobilized. They can't solve the problem. The only people who can solve the problem are the voters. But if they don't come back with good ideas, then the voters will knock it down. So
Andreas,
direct democracy can be a problem, but it also can be a saving grace.
Andreas Kluth.
First of all, I have to say I agree exactly with you. Because you lived there and because you came from outside, as I did, you saw that direct democracy is a large part of the problem. Part of it is confusion over the word democracy. James Madison didn't want it even used in the Constitution of the country because he was afraid. They had studied ancient Athens, which was a failure because of direct democracy. They had studied Republican Rome, which was very stable. They wanted Rome, not Athens. Fast forward. Here is the word count of the longest initiative, 15,633 words. I remember driving in the car when several propositions were decided last year. An English teacher called in and says she's not able to understand the initiatives on the ballot on grounds of syntax. That's number one. People vote for double negatives when they think they're voting for the triple negative. It is in California, this is a statement against direct democracy as practiced in California, where the legislature is hobbled because it cannot amend initiatives and is unique in that respect. In California, it is the least informed way of making decisions. It is curious how often the tough-on-crime voters vote for longer prison terms but forget for the taxes to pay for larger prisons, vote for faster trains, for smaller school classes, for all these things, and somehow forget not only to vote for the taxes but then also vote for Prop 13 so that they can't even be raised.
Taxes can be raised in California.
Lawrence
Property
O'Donnell.
Taxes are the only taxes affected by Proposition 13, and what it tells you is how much they can be raised. What Proposition 13 came along and said, you know what, you're sitting here, you're living in your house, you might be on a fixed income, your house may have gone up in value dramatically over the years while you're sitting in it, living on that fixed income, and now we cannot just come in and raise your property taxes 25% next year. They put a limit in how much you could raise them, and the income tax is sitting there ready to be legislated at any time, and the income tax is the fair way to fund government because it is based on your ability to pay. Taxes can be raised.
Okay.
They never passed a bill saying taxes cannot be raised.
Bobby Shriver to respond.
I just want to make one small quibble. Actually, it's a large quibble with Gray, which is he used the phrase, voters put these initiatives on the ballot. The real harsh truth, I'm afraid, is that voters do not put the initiatives on the ballot. There's, in fact, a huge industry, which are, in effect, sort of semi-private legislatures. There are people who are very well-financed, who may not even live in California, who can hire teams of people to write legislation for the state. And some ridiculous things have been passed because people, as Andreas was saying, can't figure out the syntax. I'm a lawyer, and I can't figure out some of them. The book that comes to you when you vote is that big, and you're expected to read in very fine print those documents.
Well, I just wanted to point out this is classic California. Here you have the people who are saying the ballot initiative is terrible. It's awful. We've got to get rid of it. So we're going to use the ballot initiative to get the constitutional convention that we want. That's exactly the beauty of the system that we have, is that we, in California, we have big problems, but we also have big tools to solve those problems.
Okay. Well, I'd like to get to one more question with your indulgence, to hear from the people.
I'd like to get the panel to focus on the task at hand, and I think the task at hand is ours. We are being asked to cast a one-word answer, a vote, to a six-word question. And the six-word question is, California is the first failed state, and I'd like to focus the panel on the word is.
Lawrence O'Donnell.
I just want to check up here where it was determined that that concentrating on the word first is frivolous. What did you make of that one?
Depends on what the meaning of is is.
No, I think not at all.
Sharon Waxman.
We're clearly saying from a position of people who live in California, who believe in California, who have decided to spend our lives there, that California is currently a failed state. It makes me very sad to hear the other side of the panel paying truly lip service to the notion that, yeah, it has some problems. If you live in California and you read the news every day, it is a litany of failures, roadblocks, gridlocks, budget, pick your billion, $20 billion this week, $30 billion six months ago, whatever the hole is, it has to be filled, the latest service to be cut, the latest milk and cookies that will not be served. This is the lives of the people of the state of California. It's not a joke. It's not how bad is New York or how bad is Arkansas. This is where we are spending our lives. And for us to be arguing this, it is because we believe that California does hold the promise of being the greatest state in the nation, not because we believe it is irredeemably failed and cannot be saved.
I like to respond to that.
Ray Davis.
We believe in California. We know it will solve its problems and get better. We are doing the best we can in a very difficult time. I'm sure Sharon has noticed that there's a national recession. There are problems all over America. We are bigger than other states, and the problems sometimes are bigger in California. But they're not too big for us to solve. And along the way, we are contributing enormous productivity and innovation to America. And I suggest to you, as we get more global, we're going to rely more and more on states that can innovate, because you can't outsource an idea until someone invents it.
And that concludes round two of our debate. And here's where we are. We are now about to go into round three, where we will hear brief statements, closing statements from each of the debaters in turn. And this is their last chance to change your minds before you vote again. From the live audience vote beforehand, we know where you stood before the debate began. And here again are the results. The results before the debate on the motion: California is the first failed state. 31% of you agreed with the motion. You were for it. 25% were against it. And 44% were undecided. You'll be asked to vote again. On to round three, closing statements from each of the debaters in turn. And speaking first against the motion, Lawrence O'Donnell, senior political analyst for MSNBC and former Democratic chief of staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance.
I'm from the state where words matter. So some people have doubts about what is mean. That's a familiar question. Some people have doubts that first should be in here, which is to say, it's allowable, then, if we drop first, that there are other states doing things much worse than the California government is doing things. In the fiscal years that cover this current recession, the 2009 through the 2010 fiscal years, states have faced $256 billion in budget gaps. They've solved $73.1 billion of those budget gaps so far. Now, California, in its riches, just like New York, in its riches, has been generous. It has a Medicaid formula that is more generous than other states. If you're on Medicaid in California, you get more benefits at a higher level of income. The income cutoff is a higher level than in these other states. And so if you want to say to Alabama, go ahead, Alabama, keep it up. Keep it up. Don't let people have Medicaid if they make as much as $15,000 a year for a family of four. Don't let them have it. If you want to vote that way, and say, I'm going to penalize the state that has tried, and in its trying has the struggle then in this anti-tax environment in this country of raising the money to pay for what it has promised, and then ends up in this very difficult fight every year about how do we balance this budget that doesn't seem to be balanceable, which is exactly what happens in this state every year, exactly what happens. Then go ahead, penalize those states. Declare here tonight that Alabama has done a better job than California.
Lawrence O'Donnell, your time is up. Thank you very much. Our motion, California is the first failed state, summarizing his position in favor of this motion, The Economist's West Coast correspondent, Andreas Kluth.
California is the first failed state means simply that tonight, as we speak, it is a failure. It does not mean that 5 years from now, it cannot have made a fresh start. You have to take a vital step first. You have to admit that something has failed for you to change it. This is a sort of a microcosm of two organizations in California, one called California Forward, one called Repair California. The names will tell you nothing what they stand for. One wants to deny that the failure is fundamental and wants to fiddle here, fiddle there, and hope that it'll get better. The other is Repair California, which is the organization now pushing the initiatives for the Constitutional Convention. They want you to say that the failure is fundamental, and therefore we need a new constitution because ours is unmanageably complex, with 500 amendments, all because of initiatives. The people of California will pass those initiatives calling for a constitutional convention, and that is because the people of California take it for granted. They just assume there's a consensus that the failure is, as of today, in fact, there, that California has failed, and that we must start fresh with a new constitution to prevent it. Finally, first simply means the other states, the other 49, have to watch out so they don't repeat our mistakes.
Thank you, Andreas Kluth. Making his summarizing statement against the motion that California is the first failed state, Van Jones, former White House Special Advisor for Green Jobs and co-founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and Green for All.
I want to say that it's been posed that if you don't believe that we are a collapse, that we don't care about the people who are suffering in California. That's not true. When you are looking at how you evaluate any situation in your own life, you look at your problems, you look at your deficits, but you also look at your assets. And as long as you are breathing, as long as you have the ability to confront your problems, you're not a failure. You're not a failure until you quit. People in California have not quit. We are moving forward. We are coming together in ways that are extraordinary, and we will solve these problems. And I ask you to vote to support us, to encourage us and say that we're not failures, you're not failures, this country is not a failure. We have problems that we have to solve, and we will solve them together.
Thank you, Van Jones. Making her summarizing statement for our motion, California is the first failed state, Sharon Waxman, editor-in-chief and founder of TheWrap.com, an entertainment and media business news source.
Well, I believe the other side has actually made our point. They've said that California is filled with innovative people, it's full of ideas, that invention is still vibrant in the state and the lifestyle is beautiful. But all of that is despite the fact that the state has failed. And it's not because, and we stay there for all those reasons because we continue to push forward, but not because the state lends a hand, plays its role in providing education, transportation, a prison system, a medical system, the things that are the state. And to hear Van say that we are coming together in ways that are extraordinary, it sounds really lovely. I have no idea what that means. We're not coming together, and there's nothing extraordinary about what's happening to California as a state except extraordinarily bad, I'm sad to say. So I ask you all to vote for this proposition as a gesture of not only that we have proved the case, but as a gesture of helping take the step of consciousness and of moving California toward the right future, which is not the path that it's on.
Thank you, Sharon Waxman. Our motion is California is the first failed state, and summarizing his position against the motion, Gray Davis, the 37th governor of California, also served as lieutenant governor, state controller, and state assemblyman.
I want you to vote against the proposition because the proposition is what it purports to be. California supposedly is the first failed state. By any measure, We are more generous than virtually any other state. I was proud to provide health care to 900,000 youngsters that didn't have it when I became governor. Occasionally there's talk that maybe we have to reduce that by a little bit. I don't like it, but we're living in tough times. We're more generous on our health care programs. We supplement what the federal government does. So sometimes in tough times, we're not able to do all the things we would like to do. We're solving our problems. The people are taking matters into their own hands. I'm confident that they will adopt an open primary. I'm confident that they will give voters the chance to go out and make recommendations to change what's happening because of the shortcomings of 121 people in Sacramento. And we're going to be a very important part of America going forward in our global economy. So I would ask you to look at the proposition and say to yourself, California is doing a lot of things better than most other states. I'm not going to say it is the first failed state in America. Please vote no, which I think is number two on your list.
Very good. Great, Davis. Thank you. Our final speaker, summarizing for the motion, California is the first failed state, Bobby Shriver, Santa Monica City Councilman and co-founder of One.org and RED.
The people that the government and the sense of political compassion has created to serve are really, really bad in California. The reason that we have a lot of homeless people in L.A. is not because L.A. is big, as Lawrence suggested. It's because the policies of the state don't work. Mental health financing is with the county. Housing is with the city. They don't work together. They haven't worked. I want to reiterate, we're the optimistic people. We're not moaning and groaning. We're not, woe is us. California doesn't have a lot of brilliant people, a lot of venture capital, a lot of cool companies. We acknowledge all that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the state, which is a revenue collection mechanism. It disperses money to do things that the community wants done. If that isn't happening, the state, not the people, not our energy, not our optimism, not our tools, none of that is relevant. It's a revenue collection thing based on principles. We are not collecting and distributing the revenue to the most vulnerable people in the state today by an immense margin. The suffering there is immense. And that's why you have to vote to give a wake-up call to the people who hold the power in the state and the people of the California so that they could feel comfortable to say, you know what, we're optimistic, we're going to get it done, but we got a problem.
Thank you, Bobby Shriver. And that concludes round three of our debate. Now the results are in. They've just been handed to me. And remember, the team that changes the most minds is the team that is declared the winner. Now, our motion is California is the first failed state. When you voted before the debate, 31% of you were for the motion, 25% against, and 44% undecided. After the debate, 58% are for the motion, 37% against, and 5% undecided. The team for the motion wins our debate. Thank you very much to all of our panelists, to you and our audience. From me, John Donvan, thank you from Intelligence Squared U.S.
This Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, presented by the Rosenkrantz Foundation, was held at New York University's Skirball Center for the Performing Arts. Robert Rosenkrantz is chairman. Dana Wolf is the executive producer. Maureen McMurray and Rob Christensen are the radio producers. And I'm your host, John Donvan. For more information or to purchase tickets to future events, visit www.intelligencesquaredus.org. Intelligence Squared is distributed by NPR.